Today's show is sponsored by Cufflinks.com. That's right, our presenting sponsor all the way through the season, Cufflinks.com. Go to Cufflinks.com/DVR today. Use code DVR20 to get 20% off your order. Father's Day is coming up. Check it out. There's amazing new products at Cufflinks.com, including a selection of awesome Aladdin products. That's right. The new live-action movie from Disney is coming out, and Cufflinks.com has what you need. Check it out at Cufflinks.com/DVR today. Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. We're here to deep dive into the finale, the series finale, The Bells, Season 8, Episode 6 of Game of Thrones. My name is Axel. Ken is with me here today, and we're going to bring it all to you. But first, I do want to remind you to go to podcastwinterfell.com, become a patron. If you've loved this season for as little as $3 a month, you can become a patron. It's not just about the $3. It's about joining the crew. It's about being with us on a daily and weekly basis as we get into new and awesome TV shows. We're going to be covering Big Little Lies with Jenny, Westworld, tons of stuff. I want to have Ken come on Daily DVR now. I'm getting as much Ken as I can get, baby. It's going to be fun. So come join us at patreon.com/DVR. That's about it. Thanks to new patrons, we got Aaliyah and Jeff. We really appreciate you. You all just came on. I know Jeff knows Heath. Look at that. He's got an insider view on Heath. And actually, Heath is not here today because he's doing something really cool. He's auditioning for a movie because that's what he does, baby. But in his stead, we have the equally capable, the equally awesome, the always fantastic. It's Ken. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really good. Well, now I feel like nervous because I have a lot to live up to with, you know, trying to equal Mr. Heath, who's like an excellent, excellent partner on these deep dives that you guys do.
Thanks, pal.
I have to say that I did not envy anyone who did an initial reaction, particularly to this episode that we're going to talk about. The series finale of Game of Thrones. You and Heath did the best job you could have done. But honestly, if it had been me with you that night on Sunday night, I felt numb. I did. I felt, and not in a bad way necessarily, but I just felt overwhelmed.
Yes.
I felt confused. I felt emotionally devastated. And I don't know how many words I could have strung together. So the fact that you and Heath recorded a show on Sunday night, my hats are off to you.
Well, you know what, Ken? It was tough. It was tough. And we had talked before, hey, we're probably not going to go that long. It's the series finale. Let's just really initially react.
Yeah.
We actually went a little bit longer than we thought. We thought we might just go like 15 minutes. But that was impossible. We had to at least do double what we thought we were going to do. And I've had to really think about it. I rewatched the episode last night, and it was a lot to take because it's not just the show, right? It's
right.
You're a part of the community. And when you, as the season progresses, I find that no matter what, the people have a power. And the collective unconscious or conscious Twitter, internet, whatever, has an effect on your brain, you know? And so you watch it and you feel something. But then when you go to process it, because those means of processing are also processing and you've seen them, you kind of mimic in a sense. So I tried not to look at anything. I think I jumped on Twitter, just said, hey, oh, great episode or something. Then we went on and recorded. Now that I've had time to think about it, I have much more to say. How have you felt? Like, if you had to talk between then and now, do you think there would have been a difference if, like, you were forced? If I was like, Ken, give it a rating or give it a color, like DJ Tim Hines says, whatever, my fuchsia, give it fuchsia, Ken.
You know, that's a great question. I think if we had talked Sunday night and I had tried to put a 0 through 10 numerical number on the episode, I probably would have said 5 that night, because I would have thought, I think I would have felt like it was middle of the road. Like, I didn't hate it. I didn't know if I loved it. I was still processing. There was a lot of meat on the bone. There was a lot of things to think about, because like you just so eloquently said, it wasn't just an episode. It was all, and it wasn't just the end of season 8. It was the end of the entire series, and it was the end of my experience watching the show week to week, once a year or once every year and a half, or whenever a new season came out. So it was a lot to process. If I had to give it a numerical number now, I would say 8. Okay. I would give it an 8. Yeah.
That's interesting. See, my attitude, I was very happy with the episode, and it felt different to me. The way these last two episodes the show has constantly felt different to me. And we've talked about the changes from the books, you know, when they surpassed the book. We've talked about some of the mistakes. I think we all agree, if there's one thing that everybody can point to with Game of Thrones in the future, I think it's going to be the White Hunt, right? Like crossing the wall to get the white, that people are going to say, oh, what, you know, and even when the books come out, if it's in it, if it's not, which a lot of people think it won't be, it's kind of going to be pointed to as like a television convention or something. But when I think about these last two episodes, and I'm about to say something crazy here, Ken.
Okay, I'm ready.
I think that this was one of the best episodes of television ever produced.
Wow.
I'm
provocative.
I'm not saying it's my favorite.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not saying this is my favorite episode of television ever. I'm not saying when I was done with it, I was like, wow, that was the best thing I ever saw. It shocked me. It delighted me. It made me cry. It made, you know, depths. But I think they went for something different in these last two episodes, and perhaps it's a consequence of condensing this story, which we all know they did for – we can't just blame it on Dan and Dave. There's thousands of people involved in the production and contracts, and the show had to come to an end, okay? It wasn't going to continue. And as time comes on, we're going to find out the actual production reasons, but we don't know. We're just fans, and we don't know what people are saying right now. We'll read that tell-all book in 15 years.
Right.
But I feel like these two episodes were like Shakespearean plays.
Yeah.
The sacrifice of Varys, or Varys, however Donald's going to – I sometimes pronounce it differently just to kind of poke Donald, because he still makes fun that I don't know how to pronounce it. And then I forget and I mispronounce it anyway. I try to do it as a joke and then I can't remember what the right one is. But his sacrifice leading to what Danny did, leading it to the aftermath, right?
Yeah.
Leading to what John does, leading to the epilogue. And it's masterful. And I know that we could pick it apart and find, oh, this could have been another episode, or if they expanded here, but they didn't. What they gave us, I think, was brilliant. I'm not totally satisfied in many ways. And in many ways, I was unhappy with some of the choices that they made. But when I rewatch this thing, I mean, I've never seen anything like that on television before. When Danny stands in front of the Unsullied and the Dothraki and the city is burning in the background.
Here is the trick that Dan and Dave and the production team did with that speech. I'm glad we're starting there. If you look at the words and even her tone, it's like any speech that Danny has given in the last 8 years. You could have put that speech, except for maybe a few phrases, you could have put that speech when she killed the Calls, or when she killed the Masters of Marine, or when she took the Unsullied from the Masters at Astapor. That speech could have gone anywhere, and tonally, and for the most part verbally, that was a stock Daenerys speech. But the trick that Dan and Dave did, and as because they not only wrote this episode, but they directed this episode, they suddenly made it ominous and made it like she was a fascist and that it was scary and dark and foreboding. And suddenly the things that you would have cheered at 2 years ago suddenly felt spine tingling.
I thought it was brilliant, man. And that was, I felt like it was such a set piece. I feel like the show reached an epiphany, a level where every scene was just a tremendous set piece. When Jon and Tyrion talk to each other, that was like the epitome of years of, what do they call them? Twofers, two people in a room, you know?
Yeah.
It was just, I just found, and we're going to go through it. You did a great little outline here, as you always do, and I appreciate it. I just really think that once everything dies down, there's always been shows that were like too big for their own britches, whether it was like Twin Peaks, even hell. Remember when Who Shot JR?
Yeah.
You know, things that have galvanized conversation. And I think when it settles down, people are going to see this as an maybe they didn't love every part of it, but an achievement in television.
Well, let me throw this at you, since we're talking kind of big picture here. I'm a firm believer that art has two components, the art itself and the atmosphere of the audience. Mm. Not just the audience, but the atmosphere of the audience. So here's something that I've thought about, sort of the social media aspect or the backlash, quote unquote. If we lived in happier times in our lives right now, if this were a more content, prosperous, happy world that we lived in 2019, would we be more accepting of an ambiguous, dark, bittersweet ending to a grand mythic story? But maybe because our world feels so dark, complicated, divisive, maybe the audience wants the opposite in their art. Maybe a lot of people want the opposite in their art from the way the world that they live in feels like. Yeah. Maybe if things had been more, you know, fist pumpy, more epic, less ambiguous, less bittersweet, maybe a lot more people could get behind the way this story ended tonally. So sometimes I think about things like that too.
I think that that's completely valid. I really do. And I think that may have something to do with why certain decisions were made by the artists themselves, right?
Right.
You can't help but reflect that. And what you talk about is kind of like the Schrodinger's cat of art, right? That the observer changes the experiment.
Yeah.
Really defines the experiment. Not changes it, defines the experiment. The observer is the experiment. We are what the art is.
Yeah.
And that is always why I think that, you know, it's interesting that Game of Thrones becomes such a huge thing and people talk about plot arcs and stories and what's earned and they use different phrases. And it brings me back to being in college and breaking down different novels, and which is really just working with the text, right?
Yeah.
And Heath and I talked a little bit about that. And one thing that gets forgotten, unfortunately, in the internet is people to start saying, like, my reading of the text is, instead of, you know, Dan and Dave are the most racist, whatever, terrible. You know, like, it's like you frame it as an indictment of the creator instead of a subjective reading of the text and of the work, which is I'm always open to that, and I'm not so open to the former. And I think that's what we always try to do, is just like read the text and kind of talk about it. So you do get caught up in all of that, especially in a series and a series finale. So when I rewatch it, I try to take myself out of that. I felt like I did a good job, and I felt like doing the whole rewatch of the series was a good way to prepare myself for this season.
Yeah.
And another aspect to art that's awesome, Ken, is art that when something is great, it perplexes you. When art is like revolutionary and different, which I actually am saying that I think this episode is.
Yeah.
It shocks people, and some people's opinion of it is that it's complete garbage.
Yeah.
You know, like when Star Wars came out, when 2001 came out, people said, this is total filmic masturbation. This is total garbage. It makes no sense. They're just trying to, you know, Kubrick's trying to do high art for art's sake, blah, blah, blah. Now we look at it as a masterwork. I think that this episode is a masterwork. And
well, can you think, and I'm sure this is one of the things you're thinking of when you say what you just said, can you think of any other story where the sensitive, reluctant hero who always tries to do the right thing and is secretly the rightful heir to the throne ends up bittersweetly and with lots of resignation walking away from all of it into the woods with the wildlings at the end of the story? Like, I mean, that in and of itself is so revolutionary because it's so bittersweet, ambiguous. And it's not what you would think, how you think a story like that would go, given all of the tropes that sort of surround a character like Jon Snow, because in some ways he feels so familiar, like Luke Skywalker or Frodo Baggins or any other hero that you can think of in like a classical way. But the fact that they ended that story, just his story alone, just looking at his story, the fact that he stayed reluctant till the very end, never wanted it, meant it when he said it. And then the fact that he just didn't want to live in a world where he had to kill the love of his life in order to save the world. And so the fact that he walks off with the wildlings at the end, maybe he's going to come back to the wall. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just going to live up there with them forever. I thought that was amazing.
Yes. I thought there was a lot of choices here that were fantastic. But I do want to say one thing. I don't want to mislead. The aspects that of this episode that I think are a masterwork are not really based on plot stuff for me. For me, it's based more on a method of storytelling.
Okay.
And kind of a fulcrum of the acting, production, direction, and what had come before. I don't love, like I'm going to say, I don't love all the choices that were made. And I think some of them I find a little suspect as far as continuing the story goes, though I love that part. But I really just mean like as an episode, as a single episode of television, I really think that this is an amazing series finale, whether... And which makes it even better, Ken, because I'm like leaving it open. You might not like some of it, but you can't dispute that I think that it fulfilled so much in so many characters. And the John thing was probably my favorite part. So the fact that you brought it up, I still had to be like, you brought up the one part thing that agrees with that. But I have to say that people might have – I can still understand why, like, there's certain things that happen. Like, I'll say, like, Brienne and the Brienne-Jamie part. For me, that was not as satisfying as it might be for some people. I found that actually to be kind of unsatisfying that her – that was such a big part of her ending. But maybe it says more about her. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't know. I guess, well, let's talk about it. Let's jump right in. Let's start where it starts. And what I thought was, again, a brilliant part of this, because it echoes back to the funeral scenes we had after the Long Night. Right. Yeah. Like the episodes are starting to mirror each other. And that's Tyrion finding his siblings. What did you think about this? I was shocked that this was such a big part of the beginning, and I absolutely loved it.
Well, I loved it, and it made me think differently about Jaime and Cersei's final scene in the episode before, because it created a bridge between those two scenes for me. And it created one big final picture of the ending of that family. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they gave Tyrion, and that was a long sequence that would like, because we had to watch him walking through, and he walks past the table for the council, and he picks up the torch thing, and he goes down the stairs and blah, blah, blah. And he finally makes his way. Right. And so then he starts to lift the bricks away because he sees Jamie's hand. I have to say that so that was in the first 10 minutes of the episode. I cried my eyes out. Like, it brought such an emotional resolution to the end of two characters who meant so much to me and are arguably maybe my two favorite characters in the entire story. Or they're in the top five for sure. And so him finding them and him reacting, like, give Peter Dinklage an Emmy right now, right?
Yes.
So, like, his performance in that scene, even though he didn't have any dialogue, it was amazing. So I got to grieve through him for them. And it doesn't mean that I like Cersei and that I like all her choices, but it was a brother finding his brother and sister dead and saying goodbye to the last two members of his family who were alive, and realizing he's the last Lannister. And he was bereft. He was devastated emotionally, and it was all in his face and his body language. And so that felt cathartic to me, and it made me feel like, cause I felt there was a small part of me that felt cheated about the end of Jaime and Cersei at the end of the episode before, just because it happened so quick.
Yep.
But given that they spent so much time with this sequence, it made me feel like it was filled in.
I don't know what I could say better than what you just said, Ken, because that's exactly how I felt. Exactly. Yep. I just have to mention, as I was called out on Twitter, excuse me, this is some deep womb shit, homie, right? They are real. Like, I was talking about the wombs last episode.
Yeah.
This is some real womb shit. I mean, they are like fetal, right? In their positioning and the way he finds them and the way he's looking at them. It is crazy. And this whole castle, which later he's upstairs leading the meeting.
Yes.
It's crazy, right? Like, it continues. And the way that is, in a sense, his burden. I just thought it was, I couldn't believe that they took like 10 minutes or so for this scene and this sequence. The crawling up, the looking at the little hole, and like Heath had mentioned, who else would be small enough to be able to climb through there, right?
Yeah.
And kind of remove this stuff. Like, it was... It was absolutely beautiful, and for a show that's accused so much in this season of being rushed, they really took their time with this. And it,
you know,
it, and I'm sorry. Let me just say one thing before I forget, Ken. You brought up a point. Jaime and Cersei are, no matter what they say, no matter how nice Jaime was, I always saw him as the guy who pushed the kid out a window. No matter, even through all the changes and his so-called redemption, I still saw that as a part of him, right? And Cersei too. So the only person who could bring us to love them, we could only love them through Tyrion. Right? So that's why this had to be their goodbye. He had to do it for us. And I thought that was really brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't have anything else to say. I just thought, I mean, the only thing I could possibly add is that once again, from a technical point of view, the camera did amazing work. And that last overhead shot of Tyrion looking down on them and all three of them are in the frame was amazing.
Yep. Wow. That was crazy, man. Well, we talked a little bit about it. The next scene is Dany giving her speech and kind of the camera coming up through. We get to see the crowd. We get to see what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And the of the Unsullied, which we've seen many times before. You're right, Ken, that they're in this this battle cry, this war speech. There were so many callbacks to other times she had done this, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that she was so uplifting, right? Like, she came out with what many are dubbing now the best shot that Game of Thrones has ever done. It's pretty slick how the dragon wings become, and she, like we had talked about, she became the dragon, right?
Yeah.
And this speech was, to me, the thing that was so crazy about it and what made what John did work for me is how happy she was.
And how calm she was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She wasn't, she didn't get off, like, not showing her on the dragon while she was destroying King's Landing was such a brilliant decision, because now when we finally see her and she lands and she walks up, at first I thought when the wings spread, I thought, are we going to get like, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, Maleficent, right? That the Disney like bad queen, right?
Yes.
Is she going to be like rubbing her hands? Ha ha ha. We have destroyed King's. No. She came out like she did when she burned the Dothraki. Like when she did, you know, when she was Khaleesi for the first time out the fire. Like she was triumphant.
Which made it even more.
Ooh. Yeah.
Like made it even more terrifying.
Yep.
And also, the other difference between this speech and any other speech she's ever given is that we got to see the reaction shots of Jon and Tyrion.
Oh, yeah.
And like the horror on their face and like the shell shockness of their faces. So we were like looking at her through them. And it was surreal. It was surreal. That whole speech was surreal. Like, and not, and in the worst possible way.
Yeah, man. Well, I have to say that one of the things that, after the last episode, I had said on a pod or whatever, I don't remember where, if somebody tells you again and again, you know, it's my destiny to rule, you know, and you see that they have this power, when they make that turn, it's, I watched this series on I guess it was not called, Tyrants, but it was about, different dictators throughout history. It was on PBS. It was great. They did like Stalin, Hitler, all these different people, of course, the big ones, you know, the popular ones. And they talk about the carrot and the stick, which Dany employed. They talk about, and how when the turn is made, it's so subtle because they do it just like they did everything else. There's no real change. It's just their action was different. Instead of killing this person, they killed that person. But they keep on telling you that that's the right thing to do, right? And that's exactly what I was, I was like brought into that PBS special because they would stop it and have like a historian chime in and go, okay, now watch what, and I was like waiting for that to happen during Game of Thrones and be like, see how this seems just like you said, just like every other speech she's given, except she just killed all these people who now you don't think are innocent. Well, guess what? All the other times she killed people, there was someone who thought they were innocent.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right? And that part was never really considered.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It was never really considered. It was just, you know, the cheers. So I kind of feel like in a way, and I don't want to indict people who are fans of Dany, because I know Lady Solo is a Dany fan. But sometimes I feel like stories can be like a test for you, you know? Like, did you fall for it? And
well,
I mean, so I feel like in this one, they did a good enough job of setting Dany up. Now, she could have went the other way, but at least the thought that she could have gone this way should have been on people's minds.
I'm going to push back a little bit and say she was never going to go another way.
Oh, okay.
But here's the difference. Like, here's what makes her Shakespearean to me. She had a picture in her head of what she wanted, but she continually made choices. And it's so clear now when you look back that she was continually making choices that were actually taking her in the opposite direction from the picture in her head. And that's what makes her Shakespeareanly tragic. And that's what made me, the thing that made me cry in her final scene, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a few minutes, isn't that she needed to die because of where she had put herself, and John needed to do what he did. But the thing that made me emotional about it is what her hopes and dreams had been. The scared little girl who was being raised by the abusive brother, who just wanted to live in a world where she was loved and respected. And she thought that was all wrapped up in the Iron Throne. Like, the two things became interconnected in her mind.
Yeah, that's a great
point. And she couldn't let it go. Like, she couldn't separate her personal happiness from her political ambition.
And power.
Over others.
Over her, and dominance over others, you know?
Well, here's the thing that she never learned is that she never learned to modulate, like, that power has modulations. Like, so power was just power, whether it was over the Masters of Meereen or whether it was the people of King's Landing who needed to be sacrificed in order to defeat her enemy. Like, power is just power to her, and it's just a blanket thing to her. There is no difference in her mind between killing the women and children of King's Landing and killing the evil slave masters of Meereen, because both of them stood between her and what she wanted.
Yes, you're right. They're the enemy, right? Like I was talking about before. They're interchangeable enemy, because the real enemy is just anyone who opposes her and opposes her path to power. But I have to say, like I was saying about that test, I have to say what I find fascinating is that I think I've failed the test at times. I was totally like, yeah, go Dany. You know, like, I think that that's what made the journey interesting to me. I think that they, at many times, they got me. You know, they got me to cheer for that. And then I would think later, I'd say on the pod, yo, she really does, but killing people is killing people, you know? Like, you know, I've said I'm a pacifist. I'm not one who believes in capital punishment. I don't think you should kill people. So she does. You know, I guess a lesson is there's the fine line, you know, and we as a society run that line. And war and things like this constantly make us question that. And a big part of, you know, George's story is anti-war. And I think Game of Thrones, too, that in the end, what does it really achieve? And we see a lot of people making the same mistakes. And I think that there are actually people who failed Dany. And I think John is one of them. I think he failed her. And I think that it was easier for him. And this is a hard thing for me to say, but it's true. It was easier for him to stab a knife into her than to earlier actually tell her how he was feeling or try to get other people to work together to help her. And I know that's part of this grand play. They're not going to sit down and have a therapy session. You know what I mean? Like, that's a different world.
Right.
In my mind, I can see how there's inherent in it a failure of communication. But the whole thing, just to keep on talking about this big speech, the spectacle of it was amazing too. I mean, her speech, her performance, but that shot when she looks back and you see the city burning and the Dothraki are whooping and hollering and the Unsullied are there. I mean, it was just amazing. And leading up to when they stop the because Tyrion steps forward, and let's talk about that. Tyrion quits in front of everybody.
Yes.
Which brought such a – it was weird because there she's giving her big, huge speech, you know, and it was so reminiscent of other – like speaking of Hitler and Stalin and these big, you know, parades that the dictators love to have, right?
Yeah.
But for him to intercede with such an almost personal gesture, right?
Yeah.
And he's so little.
And oh, my gosh.
Right in front of everybody.
Yeah.
That was an amazing scene.
So I have a question for you. How much of that, in your mind, either on the initial watch or the rewatch, was what she did at King's Landing and the realization that Varys was right? And how much of it was she killed his brother and sister?
I think there's a good – it definitely – It's hard to relate it directly to what happened, even though it just happened, because it's such a grand spectacle, right?
Right.
But I think that it's everything, but you're right. That was the final straw, that almost also seeing, in a sense, their deaths, how he personalized them to us, and these grand characters were just sitting there. Nobody even went to get their bodies, right?
Yeah.
She was the queen. And their bodies are just there like junk, rubble, nothing. And then it just makes it so low. And then he kind of lowered. Tyrion brought that mood to Dany's speech. You know what I mean? Like, he was like, you're so big.
Yeah.
I'm taking this moment away. So I think you're right. I think there's a connection there. Definitely. Of course. Yeah.
Well, and here's the ironic thing. She may have been the one who actually opened his heart, right? Like, his heart had always been a little closed off because of the way he was raised. But then after killing Shay and his father, then he was in a downward spiral. And it was meeting Daenerys, and it was her what he perceived as her desire to make the world a better place that really opened up his heart and his mind. And maybe for a while it discombobulated his thinking and his scheming and his ability to make good decisions, because maybe he was thinking too much with his heart. But it's ironic that maybe she was the one who opened up his heart. And then ultimately it was that open heart that led to his inevitable objection to what she was doing.
That is totally, I love it, Ken, because you're right. Because see how this story becomes now not just about Dany making this choice, but how this choice is a stab in the back to Jon and Tyrion and Davos and people who believed in her. That's why that's such a big part of what Tyrion says to Jon, right?
Yes.
Is that we have to see that it wasn't just people going, oh no, she has too much power. It was a, they took personal, it was A2 Brutus, right? Like they took personal offense to what she did. Yeah. Not just that she killed people and she's going to continue to go on a rampage, which was true, but it was also like, yo, we built this city together, right? We were supposed to be building this together, Danny. What are you talking about? Because isn't that the game though, right, Ken? Like when the leader goes, come on, everybody, we're going to do this together. Come on, everybody. But then when everybody disagrees with the leader, then the leader turns around and goes, oh, but what I meant the whole time was you're doing this for me.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
I didn't mean come on, everybody. I meant come on, listen to me. And that's what Danny was always saying. That's what I kind of mean. Like Danny never was like, the people must unite. She was never like, I free you slaves to become your own Khaleesi's. No, she was always like, I free you. Now you have a choice. Believe in me or not. You know what I mean? Like that was the choice.
Well, and also the idea that a villain is the hero of their own story is not a new concept.
Yep.
But the way that George and then Dan and Dave constructed this particular villain story was so subtle and so gradual that all of us failed the test, right?
Yeah.
Like most of us failed the test. Like we were all shouting our support in all of those scenes from like season two, season three, season four.
I was doing it a couple months ago in the rewatch. I was like, I like Danny better now.
And so, but see, maybe that's the way for everyone who still can't wrap their mind around the turn, as it's now being called. Maybe we need to look to Tyrion's character in order to find the resolution to that, because he was able in a later scene in this episode to still mention about how she wanted to break the wheel and how they can still make the world a better place. So Dany did still have a positive effect on the people in her orbit, particularly Tyrion. And so she did good. She did a lot of good. She freed all of those slaves in Slaver's Bay and gave them agency in their lives for the very first time. Think of the positive effect she had on Missandei, on Grey Worm. So
definitely,
Dany did a lot of good. The fact that her philosophy accelerated to a point where it became black and white, and where it was easy for her to then turn on people that we now consider to be innocent. That makes sense, especially when you think about it in retrospect. But it doesn't take away the positive effects that she also had as well.
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And that's why we watch a whole story, right? Yeah. Because there was always that question. And though I can see your point that she always was going to be this, you know, I'm sure, Ken, if we said, hey, let's write some fanfic, let's do a fanfic pod where we do a series of scenes in which Danny chooses not to do this, and there's a different story told, it could have been, you know what I mean? Like I'm saying that to me is why that is a mark of kind of like a good tragedy, that you feel like you could go back and be like, oh man, maybe if they did this, but then in the end you're like, no, that was their destiny. But then you're like, well, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of still, because I kind of still want to like her. I still kind of wanted to like Cersei.
Yeah.
You know, I still wanted to kind of like Jaime. I find myself falling on the way against Jaime thing as the series comes to an end. But maybe I'll go back another way. Well, let's talk quickly about Arya warning Jon. This was a subtle, she's just there, right? Yeah. And he even says, what are you doing here?
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Yeah, she's spooky.
That was actually a little bit of comic relief that I also found just kind of weird and funny. Like, it was pretty confident that they just put this here. But this helps in going into the next scene with Jon and Tyrion. What did you think about what Arya said to Jon?
Well, I thought that it serviced getting Jon mentally and emotionally to the point that he needed to get to. Yeah. And this was like the first step.
Yep.
Because had Sansa said that to him, it wouldn't have meant as much. It had to be Arya who started the ball rolling. Because Arya is the sibling that he's the closest to. She's probably the human being that he loves and trusts the most, period. Besides his father. But she's probably the relative who's alive, the human who's alive, that he feels the closest to. So she had to be the one to start to say this to him, to tell him the truth, quote unquote. And it didn't stick, but it was a first step. Yeah. And it was an important first step for her to call Danny a murderer in front of him, or a killer is actually the word she uses. And to remind him that Sansa is not going to accept this and that it's the same choice that his dad faced. Is it duty or is it your family? What's more important?
Yeah.
And that's the same choice Ned had. Because if you remember at the end of season one, when Varys first goes down there and's like, oh, you need to, you know, say this and this about Joffrey. And Ned's first reaction is, what, you think my life means something to me? I've been ready to die for a long time. But it isn't until Varys brings up his daughters that he's like, oh, wait a minute. So it was an important thing for her to say to him. It was important that she said it.
Yeah. And I think that is maybe what leads him to go to Tyrion. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, that's something that I was thinking about. We did a little pre-show and we're trying to think like, what's going to happen? Tyrion's obviously going to be in trouble, blah, 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 you know? And then as the show progressed and as this scene's happening, and I'm kind of thinking in my head at a certain point, like, oh my God, what's happening? I have no idea what's going to happen next. And that's what I loved about this episode too. For him to then go and have that scene with Tyrion when he was walking through, and I think I'm remembering this correctly, when he takes his sword off and he hands them his sword, I didn't know where he was going, you know? And then they open it up and he's going into Tyrion's cellar. Did they show Tyrion first? I think we didn't know where he was going, right?
Absolutely, because he could have been going to see Danny.
Yeah, okay, good. So I'm just in the haze of it all. I want to make sure, right, because they do that kind of twice, because then when he eventually sees Danny, it's the dragon that lets him through with that amazing shot.
But, oh, my God.
But this was cool because I was like, I just felt like I got a rush when I saw that he was going to talk to Tyrion. And the reason I did is because it's that play thing that I don't know how to go back to it. I mean, maybe they'll talk about it in this 2-hour documentary, but I just felt like it was such a play like structure where you just go to the thing that happens next. You know what I mean? Like, it was just brilliant that they just did it. He just goes to Tyrion.
Well, you brought up Shakespeare at the beginning of this, and Shakespeare would do this all the time, where one scene would organically lead to the next scene. And so had Arya not just said that to him, he might have chosen to go see Danny had Arya never appeared next to him.
Yeah.
Because maybe he thought, I can talk her out of it. I can work this out. But because Arya says what she says to him, the next person he wants to go see is Tyrion. And one thing followed the next. Then he talks to Tyrion. And then that leads to his next scene. It's all very great. Organic and it's interconnected.
It was it's just like the beginning to the last episode where Varys writing the letters, going to Jon, Tyrion watching, going to Dany, going to the execution. Like, it's just really, I know people this is a controversial episode in the zeitgeist and whatever, but I think when you just look at it, this is really brilliant writing. This is so well paced. It's efficient. And I thought it was pretty wonderful. And this scene that we get with Jon and Tyrion is, and Heath and I are going, I was going to reenact it with you, Ken, but I thought he is Heath actor. So I can't take that away from him.
Of course not. No.
So we will reenact this scene on next week's podcast because I really want to do it. But and we're also going to do the Jon and Dany death. I think we're going to do both of the scenes.
Good. But
this is just, I mean, Tyrion has, what, two masterful speeches. And this is the first one. He just lays it out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just very simple, and it's with passion, with talking about him, his own experience, right?
Yeah.
Empathizing and sympathizing with Jon, even about loving Dany.
Isn't this what we wanted? Like, we were like, where's Tyrion?
Yes.
Where's Tyrion?
Yep.
Tyrion showed up in this episode, and not only Tyrion from season 2, season 3, season 4, not only that Tyrion showed up, but like Tyrion 2.0 showed up, because now he's infused with heart as well because of his experiences with Dany.
Yeah.
He's more hopeful, less cynical version of early Tyrion. And so his wisdom, his intellect was on full display in this scene with Jon. It was masterful is a great word, Axel. It was a masterfully written scene. It was a masterfully acted scene. It went on for like, I don't know, 6 minutes, 8 minutes. It went on for a really long time. And it was like Jon was at point A at the beginning of the scene. And because of what Tyrion said to him, he got to point B by the end of the scene. And it all made sense. Like it all just worked. Like Tyrion's job was to get Jon to a certain emotional place. And he did it. Yeah. He totally did it.
He did. And it didn't seem manipulative.
Well, no, because he was telling him the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, he was telling him the truth. And sometimes, I guess, depending on your point of view, the truth could be manipulative, right?
Oh, is the most manipulative thing.
Absolutely. Well, and Tyrion references it later in the episode when Jon's like, is it right what I did? And then Tyrion corrects him and says, what we did. Because Tyrion is well aware of the fact that he talked Jon into it.
Yeah, and that's the point I love too, is that, and that's what I love about Tyrion, right? And actually, I'll tell you a little secret here, Ken. This is, my dad taught me this secret when I was young. And when he said to me too, he said, all lies should be based in the truth. Huh. And he said, think about that.
Yeah.
You can never tell it. Like if your mom asks you, where did you go? You got to tell a little bit of the truth in it or else she's not going to believe your lie when you don't want her to know. My father was a con man. A very good one. Oh man, what a discussion Ken and I are having. It is so wonderful to have Ken on the show. He is the best. Love you, Ken. Sending it out through the ad right here. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR today. Father's Day is coming up. Take 20% off an order of $150 or more by using the code FANCY. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR today. Check out their new Aladdin products. And don't forget, email us at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com to win a pair of Targaryen cufflinks by telling us your favorite moment of the series. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR. Thank you, Cufflinks, for your continuing support. We love you, Cufflinks. Cufflinks.com/DVR today. So the second thing that my dad told me, part of the con man Bible, Ken, is always be self-deprecating. And that is one of the things that I always have loved about Tyrion, right?
Yeah.
You can't, when someone stands in this world, when someone stands in front of you like a Dany,
yeah,
and they are never self-deprecating, they never make fun of their power or the way people see them, they take themselves so seriously, you can't connect. And Tyrion is always self-deprecating, and he always, and not only in making fun of his stature or his family, but also he is open. He says to Jon that he loved Dany.
Yeah.
Right? And he admits something that scene that we saw last season, remember, that was so talked about?
Yes.
And remember, everyone was like, is Tyrion going to defy Dany? Is he going to turn his back on her because she loves Jon and all that? No, it's what you said. It clouded his judgment.
Yes, it did.
Yep.
So that was the answer to the question, like, why has Tyrion been off his game?
Yep.
Why did he lose his mojo? Because his intellect was clouded by his feelings of love for Daenerys.
Yep. He was Tyrion friend zone.
Yes, he was.
Him and Jorah. That is a sequel that we need to see. Tyrion, right, and Jorah friend zone together.
That's right.
You can count on me. Jorah. You're jumping in the fountain, you know, while Dany flies around on a dragon, but we never see her. She's not in the sitcom, you know, they just talk about her. It's like Batman and all those DC shows. They just talk about him, but he's not, you never see him.
That's funny.
But this really was an Emmy award winning for best actor, not supporting. For best actor for Peter Dinklage and also Kit Harington. I mean, look,
oh my gosh.
You know, I have to admit, I've accused John and Kit Harington of being mopey mopersons, of being sword bro. Yeah. And he brought it, man. I mean, through that tangled, curly, greasy hair, he was getting like Daryl from The Walking Dead up in here.
Yeah.
He really, in this scene, he gave the face, man. You could see the gears turning in John's head.
Well, often, and you probably know this, the person who is being convinced in some ways has the harder acting job because they don't get as much dialogue and they're reacting to the person who's trying to convince them of something. But you have to see the gears turning in their head to see whether it's working. And in this case, Kit Harington did a great job of letting you see how Tyrion was getting to him.
Yeah. Yep. That's true, man. He was fighting against it.
Yes.
What he was saying. But Tyrion was he remained steadfast throughout, regardless of John's demeanor or John's challenge.
Yeah.
Because he was acting not as if he was trying to convince him of something, but rather he was just speaking the truth to him. Right? Like he was like, you know, this is true. Like there's no question. Like I can't, like we're not having, I am, what I'm doing here is offering you reality. And what,
well, like,
you know, go ahead.
Well, like how, like in the real world, it would be like when you're trying to tell your friend that his girlfriend's dirty or like she's doing him bad behind his back.
She's doing him dirty.
Right. And so it's like he doesn't want to believe it, but like deep down inside, he knows it's true.
Yes. It's so much. You know what? It's funny, Ken, that so much of what happened with John and Dany this season can be about one of them cheated.
Yeah.
You know, and they can't get, like, I started watching, this is a total digression, I'm sorry,
it's
I started watching Vanderpump Rules. on Hulu. Don't ask me why. It's because I love The Bachelor and I listen to this podcast with Juliet from The Ringer and she loves Vanderpump. And so I started watching it. And they're horrible, terrible people. Please tell me you've never wasted brain cells on this show, Ken.
I never have.
Okay, good for you. I encourage you never to watch it.
Okay.
But it is really fun. And the show is absolutely just cray cray, and everything ends up being about somebody cheated on somebody's, you know what I mean? And it's just, it's always the same thing. The person just doesn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're like, they never bring it to them and they go, oh, I knew it. They always go, you're lying because you hate me and my love, you know? And the thing that they did good here with John is everything happens with him internally.
Yes.
He keeps on having these scenes where he says, Danny's my queen. Or he says to Varys, you're talking treason. But he doesn't do anything about it. He didn't report her. He didn't report Varys to Danny. Tyrion did. Right?
Yes.
John has always been listening. So I think that this final scene here is not John all of a sudden deciding out of nowhere to take out Danny. This is the last straw. And he's hearing it from a guy who he knows was one of the few people in the entire land of Westeros to speak to him as a man and piss off the top of the wall with him. You know, and they've lived many different lives in those years, right? And he knows what Tyrion has been through. He knows that John, that Catelyn, the complicated relationship, all the history they have, and the history their families have, comes to play in this one scene.
Well, I'm going to push back a little and say only that I don't think that he convinced him to kill her. I think, from my point of view, I think he convinced him to open his eyes, to see it with fresh eyes. And that, I feel like that compelled John to go talk to her and to see if there was anything that she could say to him that would change the picture that Tyrion had drawn.
You know what, Ken? I think that that's a distinction that would be personal, right? Like, I could see it being written, and as it is in the show, perhaps when Tyrion says you have to make a decision now.
Yeah.
For me, I think Tyrion was telling him to kill her. But I can see that it was also Tyrion saying, just live in this, like accept it, right? Like you're saying, see reality as it is. And then John made that final decision when he was in the throne room there.
Well, no. I agree with you that Tyrion was saying kill her.
Okay.
I just don't think that John.
Oh, that it worked. Okay. It worked that way. That John.
Right.
Right. I understand what you mean. He made his own decision.
Right. I don't think John was like, yes.
I agree.
Yeah. I think John was like, well, Tyrion's given me a lot to think about. Mm-hmm. And my eyes are opened in a way that they weren't open before. But I still want to go talk to her one last time before I make a final decision.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100,000. Totally agree with you on that point, Ken. You're right. I don't think, yes, totally. Because that was – I don't think Tyrion was really I don't think Tyrion thought he could do that anyway.
True. Good point.
You know, as far as what we've seen of this character and what he has said of Jon Snow and the ways that he has really come to trust Jon Snow, you know, and respect him, right?
Yep. Yep.
Really tremendously, I think. And I think love him. I think Tyrion loves Jon Snow like a brother.
Yeah.
I agree. I think that's like his Jaime, you know?
Well, Tyrion never had a little brother, but I feel like that's
a good point.
Because Tyrion was a baby of that family, of his own family. But I feel like that was his vibe with Jon. Like, Jon's the little brother I never had.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. All right. Well, let's go to Dany and Jon. This scene that kind of, in a sense, culminates for me. And I'd like, as we go into, I'd like to hear what your opinion is, because I said this to Heath. I felt like this episode really ends with this scene, and the rest is, in a sense, the epilogue that we were talking about.
Yeah.
And it kind of is too, because of there's like a time jump, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just, I love the way this closes and the way that the entrance is protected by the dragon, the fire, who is masked almost like a weirwood tree, like a tree, right?
Yeah.
Like the symbol of the north, the cold, and a snow-covered tree. And then it shakes itself off, sniffs him again, as it will do again soon after when he kills Dany.
Yeah.
And then he just walks past. It was, oh my God, it was like, not only did it have so much meaning, as I'm talking just kind of outlined there, but it was just a brilliant fantasy, like, album cover.
Yes.
The Knight absolutely. And the Dragon. It was amazing. It was just so beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right. It's like the best heavy metal album cover that never was.
Dude, just when you said that, I heard like a Bill and Ted riff in my head. I was like, that was so fucking metal, bro. That was so metal.
And the ironic thing is, Jon is the only person that Drogon's going to willingly let in there at that point. Like, if Tyrion had walked up, or if Davos had walked up, different reaction, possibly. But it's just ironic that Jon's the one who comes because of his Targaryen blood, because of his history with Drogon and Drogon's brother. Then he lets Jon, he sniffs him and lets him through. Maybe he doesn't perceive Jon as a threat because he doesn't understand where Jon's head is. So I thought it was great. And I thought Jon was totally meant to do this. This was all Jon. Jon was the only one who was going to get into that throne room so easily at that point. Yep. He was the only person who Dany was going to at least attempt to let her guard down around. I feel like she gave it one last try to try to quote unquote seduce him, to her way of thinking.
Yeah.
And so it had to be him. Like, it was never going to be Arya. It was never going to be Tyrion. It was always going to be Jon. It was fated to be Jon. So, yeah.
I denied it. I said I wouldn't like it. And I loved it.
I loved it too. It was tragic and darkly beautiful and messy and emotional, everything about it. From a boy, here's good writing, though. Here's really good writing. The last thing I expected when the long walk Jon takes to go into the throne room, passes by Drogon, he finally gets up there. The last thing I expected in her little girly voice was for Daenerys to start talking about a memory from her childhood.
Oh.
She sounded so sweet.
I know, so creepy.
I was like, no. Oh my God. Yep. In any other context, that story would have touched me, tickled me, broke my heart a little bit. Like, but that's how the scene starts. It's her telling a story about how she was a little girl and she couldn't count to 20, and, you know, envisioning what the Iron Throne looked like. And in a way, it was sweet. But because of the disconnect tonally, because of what she just did, it was also like creepy and weird. Dude,
and let's not forget her touching the throne, but not sitting on it, right?
Yes.
Just that camera shot of her touching the shaft of the sword.
Yes.
And then you're right. She tells that silly story. And you know what it reminded me of, Ken? When I was freaking infuriated in the opening of episode when – no, the second episode when she's yelling at Jamie about how he killed her dear father sitting in Winterfell when her father killed Ned's father and brother, I mean, and viciously, right?
Yeah.
Like the disconnect was always there. It was always there.
You're
and
right.
You see it in that early scene when I said that she yelled about Jamie and nobody said anything and John didn't say anything, but Sansa looked over at her, right? All hail Queen Sansa.
Oh my God.
It took us too long to say that, Ken. But I said it to Heath. Ken, I think, you know, mental illness and mental health is a thing that people are now talking about more, which I think is very helpful in society. And I have been in a room with a person who I knew was disassociative, who was not seeing reality. And Dani in this scene is disassociative. She is in a different reality. She is in a reality where, by any means necessary, she must be queen. She is celebrating with the guy she is making lie about his true parentage. Like, she's so delusional that she thinks he's going to celebrate
with her. Yes. And props to Emilia Clarke, who has been doing, I mean, regardless of what people think about her character trajectory this season, Emilia Clarke has owned every scene that she's acted in this season.
Oh, yeah. She's taken it up, man. I really, depth there.
And then when John interrupts her little happy story about how she can't count and says and brings up like the burnt children and the dead children, the look on her face when he says that, it's almost like she's like, what are you talking about? Like she doesn't, like he's speaking a foreign language. Like she's speaking Chinese, he's speaking German. And that once again is like disassociated.
Yeah. It's and it's almost as if he had said to her, you just murdered all the Dothraki Khals.
Yes.
They all had families. They had children. And she's like, what does it matter? And you begin to see that it was always there. And you begin to see how this ultimate power, like I've said again and again, she never said, and I'm going to talk about it here because we begin with the dragon letting him in. And then at the end, the dragon, even though it seems to know that he has killed his mother, the dragon mother, right? I've always felt weird, like, because aren't the dragons able to be either sex?
You know, in some mythologies they are, and I don't know if George has ever, at least up until this point in the books, if he has nailed that down.
Okay.
As far as
I've always felt weird about it. I've always wanted to say they, not he or she. For a dragon. So I'll just say the dragon. I almost feel like that what I've always been saying about how she always used her children to kill is maybe the reason why the dragon doesn't kill John. Because it's like you live by the sword, you die by the sword, Dani. And you never once was there a scene in all of Game of Thrones. And I think actually there is stuff in the books about this, though. I'm not sure. I saw something on Twitter that was like a quote from a book. And I was like, oh, wait, that's something that might be what I'm talking about. Where she actually says, like, I don't want to use my children to kill. I don't want to use them as weapons. I want them to be free. Dragons can be – it was never like – she never had another vision for her children that didn't include them being methods of war or destruction or weapons. you know? And that's what I always found chilling and why I never, like, two things I never thought. I never thought Dany loved the dragons, and I never thought Cersei loved her kids. I think these are things that are said on the show. And as a parent, I can tell you that I would go to court to defend that neither of them love their children. You don't treat your children like that when you love them.
The thing I think of is that first episode of season 8 when John and Danny are on horseback and they're riding into Winterfell and the dragon Drogon flies by and she sees that it scares the people.
Yeah.
But she smiles. And she smiles, presumably at the time I watched the episode, I thought she was smiling with pride. But even if that's true, she was still disregarding the fear, the rightful fear that it caused in just common folk.
Yeah. And that's what turned her on about it.
Yeah.
That's what she liked. It's like, it's like the after school special dad that encourages his kid to beat up the other kids, you know, be the bully. She wanted her kids to be the bully. And, that's why I always, even though I cheered for her, once I started as the season progressed, it's like, this is really working for me.
Yeah.
And I really see it. And, also when John finally does kill her, I didn't expect it. It totally took me off guard, man.
Me too. In fact, I thought it was more likely when he said, "You'll always be my queen," and then he kissed her, that he was still waffling.
I thought not only was he waffling, but I thought he was going to let her kill Tyrion. That's what I was thinking in my head. I was thinking, they are mirroring Varys here, and we're seeing the same exact play, and next scene is Tyrion dies.
Yeah.
And then it's on to Sansa, and then it's Dany versus Sansa, and then Jon's going to have to do something. That's what I thought.
Yeah, I think
that's... saw that. I'm sorry, Ken. I got excited.
It's okay. Upon rewatch, it became clear to me that when she said the line, "I know what's good," and then he says, "But what about the people who have their own ideas about what's good?" And she says, "Well, they don't get a choice." Mm. Upon rewatch, it was clear to me from Kit Harington's performance that when she says they don't get a choice, there was a look on his face that said, "Oh, fuck, I have to kill her."
Shit.
Like, this is it. Uh-huh. This is it. Now, I have a question for you. Someone decides in their head, for whatever reason, that they have to kill the woman they love for the greater good. And then he chooses to say, even though he knows he's about to kill her, he chooses to say, "You're my queen. You'll always be my queen," and kiss her.
Yeah.
Now, I don't disagree with him doing that. I think I kind of like the messiness of that impulse, because he's feeling a lot of things at the same time. But it was an interesting choice for his character to make when he knew he was about to stab her in the heart, were for those to be his final words to her.
Well, you know what, Ken, in a way that's very Jon Snow, because in a sense, he's still keeping his oath. Right?
Like
he's almost saying to her, and it also is the opposite of what Jaime did to her father.
Oh, you're right.
Right?
Yes.
He did it right to her face. Not only to her face, but he told her he loved her, because he did. He was being honest. And he said, "You'll always be my queen," and she will always be his queen.
Oh my God. You're blowing my mind, because in essence, what he was saying is, "I'm never going to claim my birthright.
Yeah.
You're always going to be my queen. I'm always going to think of you as the rightful ruler of Westeros," and which sets up all of the decisions he makes in the rest of the episode.
Dude, it's like a man who always wears his wedding ring, even though his wife died in a car accident with her lover. You know what I mean?
Yes. Like, Yes.
He carries that burden. No matter what she did to him, to herself, how she betrayed everyone and her own vision of freedom and the future and breaking the wheel, he'll always love her. It's a tragedy. You know, it's what it's Jon Snow's burden.
So that's why I cried. Like, I cried, like, right after I realized he stabbed her in the heart and that she was dead, I started crying. And I guess I even upon rewatch, and I may have cried even more at rewatch, I wasn't crying so much. Oh, I was a little sad that Danny was dead just because the character had meant so much to me. But I was mainly crying because of Kit Harington's performance and because of what you just said, because of what it meant, like what sacrifice he was making to do what was right.
Yeah, and he had to – we all have to tell ourselves these things, right? And Jon Snow is a man who these oaths and what he swears means something to him past just the oath, right? It's almost like so much of his character, and you see Ned too, is this kind of foolish honor. And in the end, Jon Snow is able to transcend it by making it his own.
Yes.
So he still is honorable in killing the queen. He's not going to stab her in the back. He's not going to gather other forces against her. He's not going to politicize it like Littlefinger or whatever. He's just going to kiss her, tell her he loves her, and then do what he believes is actually the correct thing to do, which is to put her – it's almost a mercy.
Yeah.
You know, he sees this killing as a mercy. And that was why I found it to be so beautiful. And even though I resisted it, and you know, the tide was going, John's going to kill Danny, right? I kind of resisted that. I said, I don't know what sense that makes, but in the end they made it make sense to me. And I found it to be ultimately tragic and beautiful and fulfilling for both of these characters. Because in the end, Danny did finally find someone who loved her enough to kill her.
Yes.
Enough to stop her.
Yeah.
You know? All the other men added to her fire.
Yeah.
Whether it was Drogo, her brother, Jorah Frenzone, Tyrion, Dario, they all, Grey Worm, all these men added their own, you know, be the ruler. But it was the man who actually really loved her for her enough to see that's not who you are, but you can never stop yourself. You'll never be able to stop yourself, honey. So I have to stop you. And it was really sad. And the fact that we don't see it, that it takes place in the traditional hug and the kill, you know what I mean? Like that's like kind of an age-old way in paintings and in stories where a lover kills and a lover right into the heart like that. And even their kiss, he finally really kissed her.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, he tried. He was trying. You could see it on him. You know, unlike last episode where she was like kissing a wall. But it was really beautiful. I could see why it was really beautiful, man. And that really, I think that kind of, what do you think about the dragon part?
Well, here's the thing. Like, there's so much we don't know either as readers or viewers of this particular mythology of dragons in the TV show to know how smart they are. Like, what's the intelligence level on these dragons? Seems like they're pretty smart. So here's how I took it, and I'd love to hear your reaction. I took the sequence when Drogon, well, first of all, I thought it was heartbreaking, like the Lion King, like, you know, trying to see like if he can wake his mom up, like it was in the Lion King with Simba and Mufasa, like Drogon, like nudging her shoulder.
I know.
And trying to quote unquote, wake her up. I thought that was heartbreaking. My heart went out to Drogon. Because he just lost his two brothers, and now he just lost his mom. He's an orphan. I mean, it's sad times for Drogon. So, first of all, I felt sad about that. And then I also felt sad at his cry of grief, like when he goes up on his hind legs and lifts up his wings and just gives that mournful, like, wail of a cry. That affected me. But then I thought, oh my God, he's going to kill John. And probably a lot of us thought that, because John is not immune to fire. It's already been established that he's not immune to fire. So I thought if he burns him, he's going to burn. When he went for the throne, ultimately, I thought, here's how I took it. I thought he killed the thing. He destroyed the thing that really killed his mother.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's beautiful. I agree.
Like he looked at that throne and he thought her preoccupation with that thing and her wrapping up her future and her, all of her emotions into sitting on that thing is what killed her.
Yep.
So I'm going to destroy that thing.
And maybe that's too why he didn't kill John, because I almost felt like the dragon was saying, like, it's not my... With no one to say Dracarys, it's no longer my duty to decide these things. You know, like, I don't know. And I like what you're saying there. And I think that makes a lot of metaphoric sense. And it makes sense along the lines of the story and what the dragons have been used for and her using them to attain that. But again, we don't know. It's an animal, right? So we can't say why it did that. That was right in front of it, and it was something that could burn, right?
Yeah.
It could be. That's a metaphor too, isn't it? That in the end, the dragon just burns what's in front of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whatever it was. And it makes sense that it didn't go after Jon because Jon was a dragon rider and a Targaryen, you know?
Yeah.
And the dragon had seen Dany with him, and we had that – seen, what was it, even last season when John touches Drogon, you know, after Dany lands from the, that was from the great train robbery, or when she burns. So that was amazing.
Yes.
But either way, it was beautiful. And then when he uses his little paw or their little paw, finger to pick Dany up and take her away. And then you just are left with that little blood there on the ground.
Yes.
That was so, there was just so many pictures, paintings in this whole sequence. I thought for a second, now we jump ahead, obviously, and Tyrion is in jail and we go to the great council meeting in the dragon pit where, coincidentally, to me, was where John and Dany really fell in love and were able to like have a little side convo about her having a kid. Remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Dany wasn't pregnant. I thought for a second, maybe John's going to get away with this. Maybe he's just going to like kick the snow. You know what I mean? Like hide the blood, walk out, go sit down somewhere, and everyone's just going to be like, where's Dany? And John could just be like, I saw her and Drogon fly off.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So,
except John would never do that.
Yeah, like
John,
of course.
John will always tell the truth.
Which is why I wanted to is there anything more you want to say about that scene before we go to the great council meeting?
No, let's move on.
Which is when Tyrion – you know, we cut to black, which I believe it was a cut to black.
It was,
which is not like this show to do. It cut to black, and then and almost for a second, I thought we might get a title, which we haven't gotten since since the first episode. Remember?
Yes.
That was the last time we got an actual title on a screen during the episode where it told us King's Landing and all
Winterfell.
That. Winterfell, right?
Yeah.
It also had like a little diggly doos, like little design on it too. I remember
it did.
It took me a second to figure out and then completely accept that John walked right out of there, like went up to Grey Worm or something and said, I killed Dany and Drogon took her. Like he just spilled the beans, but it's like never even said in the show.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you assume too?
I assume that, but I guess I always assume that. Like, I assumed that if John, I mean, of all characters, John is going to do what you just said. He's going to march right up to Grey Worm and say, I killed her. Drogon grabbed her and flew away, but I killed her. I stabbed her in the heart.
Yeah.
So, of course, yeah, I mean, John's going to do that, and which makes you love John, but also be frustrated with John. It's like all the thing. It's the push-pull that we've always had with characters like John and Ned Stark is these highly honorable characters can be just as frustrating as they are admirable. Not that it's not admirable to admit to the crime that you committed, if you've committed a crime, but you know, it could have gone a lot of, like, he was honoring what he set out to do, like, yeah. What we just established, like, she was always going to be his queen. He was never going to claim the throne for himself. He had already made that decision. He said it over and over again. So, of course, he's not going to do anything that would contradict that.
Yeah. And I thought it was really cool the way they didn't even say it.
Yeah.
Now we have our Grand Council meeting.
Yeah.
Where we have I couldn't remember the line. Joker's on the left of me, clowns on the right.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, we have the people who really matter, except Sam's kind of stuck with the other people.
Poor Sam.
A lot of old white guys, Sam, and then the people that matter in the middle.
Yeah.
Tyrion just... Grey Worm trying his best to not let him speak. Like, remember? Yeah. Remember it used to be with Tyrion? What was it? I think Catelyn said it. I think Jorah said it. They told me not to let you speak. Don't let the imp speak. Remember that?
Yes.
That was a thing for a long time. And I was thinking of that when Grey Worm was trying his best. Like, you could see it on his face. But then you could also see, I was a little disappointed in Grey Worm turning heavy just because I kind of always liked Grey Worm, even though he's a baby killer. I like what Grey Worm kind of represented in this story. I was a fan of the Missandei and Grey Worm love affair.
Yeah, me too.
I thought it added a lot, actually, to the series. And to me, this was kind of Grey Worm's redemption a little bit because he did let Tyrion talk. Like, it was Grey Worm, yo. He could have, like, smacked him in the head with a spear, okay?
He also didn't kill Jon Snow right on the spot when Jon Snow said, I killed Daenerys, which maybe Grey Worm from four seasons ago would have done that.
Yeah.
But because Grey Worm was around Daenerys and fell in love with Missandei, it altered him.
Nice. Good job, Ken. That's right. And it made him a truer character in the end.
Yeah.
And he really did let Tyrion talk, you know, and he tried, I think, twice, like, what are you speak, you know? And this is where Tyrion again just steals it, convinces them all. Sam gives him a shot at democracy, which I know both of us, Ken, were like, I was thinking of you when Sam was speaking in my living room. I was like, this is our moment, Ken. It's going to happen. And then they all laugh at him, including Sansa.
Including my girl.
When they cut to Sansa, I was like, D&D personally were after Ken on this one.
They you were. Know? I felt targeted.
Oh,
I totally did. Well, I mean, as much as like half of me, my heart was broken, but half of me appreciated the punchline, you know, like it was funny that they all like took a beat and thought about it. And then they all just simultaneously started laughing and, you know, and like the line, like maybe we should ask my dog or maybe my horse should get a boat. Like that was really funny.
And you want to know something though, those lines though are actually in real life, pretty meaningful, aren't they, Ken?
They are.
Because
they are.
Similar things have been used to deny people of color the right to vote, to deny women the right to vote in our real world. So those lines were, they were funny, but they did have a sting to them. And to me, it was a lesson. It was almost, you know, a way of saying to the audience, this world is not ready for that, you know? But maybe I think, Ken, and you and I are going to have our own sequel here where Bran was not laughing.
That's right.
And he listened to Sam.
Yes.
And they talk about it. And Bran lives a long and fruitful life, and they enact democracy in Westeros.
You know what? You're like reading my mind. I'm glad that you just said what you said. What I was going to say, which you went like three steps further, which I appreciate, because my mind hadn't fully formed it yet, like your mind did. But I was just thinking, I'm just glad Sam put it out there. Like, I'm glad that it was like a balloon bubble coming from his mouth. And the fact that Sam, that a human being said those words out loud, maybe that in and of itself will have a power. But you're absolutely right. Bran did not laugh. And Bran is exactly the type of person who in 5 years, 10 years, because he's still a relatively young man, right? He's probably like 18, 19.
Yeah.
Like, so he's probably going to live a good long life. Who knows? Maybe in 25 years, the common folk have a vote too.
Yep. And that's what I was thinking, because it's also just like Bran for everyone to be laughing and him to say, I don't find that funny.
Or it's not funny because I can see the future, and in 25 years, they will be voting.
Yeah. Or say, Sam has a point, and then I go, oh. Because the guy, it was purposeful that the dude leading the charge on the laughter was the oldest, whitest guy. What's his name? I always get his name. Weiss Ray. What's his name?
Right. Royce.
Royce, yes. Yeah. Royce was leading the laughter, you know?
Yes.
So it's kind of that typical thing, you know what I mean? They've got to get their allusions to the real world in there. So it's like, you know, the older generation, the wealthier generation, the more privileged generation guy, that representative laughing at that, the loudest and kind of leading it down. And then they kind of showed on the camera, go all the way down to Sansa, the youngest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was important. Like they've said in this, I think there was a line here in this show, something like once something is spoken aloud, or there's like some line that goes like that, or maybe just in literature, but once something is spoken aloud, it can become real or something, you know, like, so it is important that Sam said it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But,
and even though I was heartbroken that Sansa chuckled at that moment, I was moments before I fist pumped in the air when she told, you know, one of the many old white men to sit down.
Yeah. Oh, that was hilarious. That was really, you think about why that scene was there.
Yeah.
You know, like, did they need comic, you know, they need a little comic relief and his character. But really the last time we saw him was an amazing scene with Jaime.
Yes.
Let's not forget that scene with Jaime when Jaime talks about loving Cersei and he talks about Catelyn. Like it was real. That was something else. So this little bit of comic relief though, to me was also a reminder. And that reminder was, those people are still here. You know, like everybody's not. And I thought the same thing with Bronn kind of stirring shit up at the small council meeting a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That not everything. This is not like it. Look up on this stage. It's not all our heroes. There are still some people here who are dumb.
Or selfish.
Or selfish, or powerful and don't know it, or privileged or don't know it, or want the old ways more than the new.
Yeah.
The struggle continues, basically, is why I thought that was an important part. but it also did show the how master it was in a way how masterful like Tyrion was as opposed to this buffoon.
Yes.
You know, like and, good try, buddy.
And it was also about like you've talked about this a lot, about the old guard and the new guard.
Yeah.
And Edmure Tully and Lord Royce definitely represent the old guard, even though they were fighting on the right side in these final wars. They still represent the old guard. People like Sansa and Tyrion and Bran represent the new guard. So the fact that Tyrion was doing most of the talking, the fact that Sansa told Edmure to sit down, the fact that Bran ultimately was chosen by these people to lead Westeros into the future, that all backs up everything that you've been talking about for years now about the old guard getting stale and the new guard coming in with new ideas. And it all just made sense to me.
Well, I think so too. And I wasn't so sure that it was going to be Bran. And initially I have to say, I mean, I think I said on the podcast with you and Matt that there'd be a lot of babies cut in half because he just seems so logic above all else.
Yeah.
But I will say this. I was a little disappointed, and the reason why I was disappointed with Bran being king, even though Tyrion's speech convinced me, of course, because it's Tyrion, it was written and delivered magnificently, and if I was in the room, I'd say, "Hear, hear."
Yeah.
But for the series, I just felt like I wanted, and I think it's something, and I think maybe you may agree with me. I just wanted a little bit more heart. You know, like to me, Game of Thrones, a song, haven't read the books yet, but I'm just saying Game of Thrones is such a hard world.
Yeah.
It's such, but also a world of gods and monsters, of mythological creatures. And many of our heroes are myths themselves. You know, they stand for other figures in literature and even religion and thought, you know, and this series have become more like that as it went on, as we're talking about more Shakespearean, right? Dramatic. Yeah. So I thought a return in the end to someone like Sam, who maybe would make, doesn't have, you know, may kind of has, he has a lineage of coming from a house, right?
Yeah.
But he's also like a total pacifist and really like a big love, a guy you want to give a hug to, you know what I mean? Like just a lot of heart in him and has made decisions based on heart and passion.
Yeah.
Would kind of center it in a way. But upon thinking about it, Bran really does make sense. And he did show, at least even in this, I would have liked maybe at one other scene with him before where maybe like he and Sansa were talking and she said something to him like, "Are you still the three-eyed raven? Or you seem more human now that the Night King has died." Or, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
It does, and you've pinpointed my only issue with the entire episode, which was that moment, even though intellectually Tyrion convinced me, I wanted Bran to convince my heart.
Yeah.
And he didn't do it, and I think that that's the – if I could fault the episode and the story for one thing, I guess I would say that – the writers and the creators and Brian Hempstead, right, who plays Bran, they all made a choice about how Bran was going to be post Three-Eye Raven.
Yeah.
And it was a very specific choice that they made to have him be like robotic and non-emotional and I see all, so therefore I feel nothing. That choice initially worked for me because I understood, like, if you know everything, then you're so overwhelmed, your circuits are fried, it would be hard for you to show a lot of emotion. Like I got it. But for him to become king and for that to make not only intellectual sense, but emotional sense, I needed him to crack a smile, or I needed him to say something inspiring, or I needed him to give a stump speech of some sort about where he saw Westeros going and what he hoped for. And like, I needed the music to swell up in the background, and for him to, like, even if it was like one or two sentences, he didn't have to give a big speech, but it would have been nice to just be able to emotionally rally behind him as well as intellectually get behind him.
I agree, Ken. And then I think as you're speaking, I think to myself, but maybe it's good he didn't, because maybe the lesson here is it shouldn't be a popularity contest.
True.
And maybe it is good to just have a really smart guy who knows history, who's kind of like, I don't know, the editor of the Harvard Law Review, be president.
Right.
Be president and have a little less, of the cult of personality side of things. You know what I mean?
That,
like, it's a two double-sided coin we see in real life. And maybe in the Game of Thrones life, it's kind of like, isn't it good maybe now that the king isn't such a like popular figurehead? He's kind of like a nerdy history person.
Yeah. Well, Game of Thrones has never seemed more timely.
Yeah.
And you and I have already mentioned it a few times, but it's never seemed more timely than this season. And I feel like George is definitely telling us something, the way in which he decided to end this story, which I'm positive these grand strokes are the way the books are going to end too. Maybe some of the details will be different in the books, but even in the books, I'm sure these big tentpole things are going to happen in the books too.
Yeah, okay.
But I feel like George is trying to tell us something. He's trying to say, let's get the most competent, capable person, maybe not the person we want to go get a beer with.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That on both sides of the aisle, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And, I often go back, you know, my favorite author, Arthur C. Clarke, had a story where in the story, I think it was like the president of the world is chosen at random. A computer would choose like 50,000 eligible people, and then they'd be chosen by lottery, and all the people did not want it. Like, one of the prerequisites was that the person had never strived for power or had much ambition.
Yeah.
They just made good decisions. And I think that this is kind of a story like that. And it's interesting to take. And as you kind of bandy about in your mind, it makes you think, you know, and that's why I like it.
Absolutely.
Because they could have went for a heartstrings moment, or they could have just went for Sansa. When Tyrion started talking and people were looking around the camera, I think that the way they filmed it, they were trying to make you think he was going to say Sansa first, just for an instant.
Yeah, for sure.
But she did speak up and she gets the North, and I loved it. And I thought that was great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I guess ultimately I wish that it had left me a little more emotionally like fuzzy, feeling a little touchy feely fuzzy, but I take all your points and I totally agree with them. And I'm sure that the longer I think about this sequence, the more I'll be like, woohoo.
So. Yeah, it was, it did surprise me. I have to say, even though I knew that the odds were on Bran, I think Vegas had odds on Bran, which was probably a spoiler. But it still surprised me. And I still thought it was going to be either Sam, Davos, or most likely Sansa.
Yeah.
And maybe I thought it would be Sansa. And I thought that she would pardon Tyrion and ask her to be a part of the crew, but she would ask Davos to be her hand.
Yeah.
But It didn't work out that way. It worked out with Bran, which also makes the story so much more intriguing as far as our minds to go on weird mythological levels too, which lets, you know what, in the order of things, we have John learns his fate, meets with his siblings, and we have the final sequence of the Starks. Let's put that together.
Absolutely.
And let's just go into Brienne and Jaime and then the new council meeting.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Brienne and Jaime first. I should say that let's end the Grand Council meeting, which is that they, do they decide here that John takes the black, or did they did say it here, right?
No, they didn't say it at the meeting. Tyrion tells him, when he goes.
Okay. So yeah. The meeting ends with them all. And let me just say on the thing that really sells Tyrion's speech is that he has the name ready, Bran the Broken.
Yes.
So it's like if he didn't have the name, right? There's a bit of marketing. Like Tyrion's so smart that he knows that because Bran is kind of like not really that exciting.
Yeah.
He has to kind of give him this like cool name. You know, and it works.
Yeah.
It totally works. And it's really cool writing too. And you can speak to that in the story. What significance does that have, Bran the Builder, Bran the Broken, like all these brands to you?
Well, there's my understanding is that there's so many reused names in these families, whether it's the Targaryens, the Starks, the Lannisters, the Baratheons, all the major families of the country, that names get reused so much that it became a way to differentiate one Brandon from another Brandon, or one, because there were lots of Aerys's, there were lots of Aegons. So it became a way to differentiate Aegon the First from Aegon the Third. If you gave them like Aegon the Great or Aegon the Cruel or, you know, whatever their nickname was, whatever they became known as. So the brand that built the brand from mythic times who helped build the wall became and also built Winterfell became Bran the Builder. But there have been lots of brands throughout Stark history. So now our latest Bran is now Bran the Broken.
I love it. I think it's so cool too, because it's almost, you know, who should fix us but a man who's broken?
Oh, it's so poetic. That's well said. Yes. Well said, Axel.
Beautiful. All right, let's talk about Brienne and Jaime. I found this scene to be a little, as I said, kind of more about Jaime than Brienne, but I guess that is part of her story too. It kind of had to happen. What did you think of this scene?
Well, as soon as she opened the book, and I don't know if you knew this, but I knew it from being a book reader. As soon as they showed her come into the room and open the book, I knew she was the captain of the Kingsguard, because only captains of the Kingsguard are allowed to write in the book.
Okay. There you go. Thank Ken. That adds so much meaning to it that I didn't get.
So the fact that she opened the book and started to write in it, to me, instantly said that she was captain of the Kingsguard. And I started crying right then and there. Aww. Because I thought, not only is she the first female knight, but she's the first female captain of the Kingsguard.
Wow. You just gave me the goosey bumps, as they say.
And so that was the emotion that carried me through. To me, see, I disagree with you. I thought this was all Brienne. I thought this was all about her. I thought this was about her filling in the story from the last captain of the Kingsguard, which would have been Jaime Lannister. But it was also her being graceful and classy and loving, but also telling the truth. And there's not many characters who can juggle all of those plates, you know, keep all those plates in the air. But Brienne is that person who can simultaneously be graceful and loving, but also absolutely tell nothing but the truth. And so I thought everything she wrote, which was just like the facts and nothing but the facts. But then at the end, see, this is how I thought. Here's how I thought this is really all about Brienne. She's writing, writing, writing. And then she pauses. She thinks because she's at the last sentence. And because she's thinking, how can I put this in a way that is absolutely the truth, but that is also loving and respectful to the man who helped me become who I am today? And so she, and then they reveal her final sentence, which is that he died protecting his queen, which is absolutely the truth, but it also kind of, it gracefully skates over the ickiness of some of their situation.
And those who know the true history will know the meaning.
Right. Absolutely.
You sold me on it, Ken, because you want to know something? I knew she was there at this small council. At the in the, she is there sitting at the table in the end, isn't she?
She is.
And it just didn't dawn upon me that that was her position. And that's why she's writing in the book. And when Jamie, I remember that that was when Jamie and Joffrey, when Joffrey had goaded Jamie about it.
Yes.
He had mentioned that too, right?
Yeah.
So I see this in a new and different way. I'm glad I listened to this podcast, Ken. That, that was great. You're right. You're totally right. I have nothing more to add.
Well, that's a great transition to the new council scene because captains of the Kingsguard get a seat on that council, which is, like you said, why Brienne was there. Here's one thing I'll say about that new council. Once again, Peter Dinklage, performance of the night.
The chairs.
The way he set up the chairs, the fact that he seemed nervous. It seemed like it was the first meeting of the council and that he was a little nervous. And I thought it was brilliant. I once again, it was one of the scenes where it took its time and they, Dan and Dave, let it breathe. The fact that they gave Peter Dinklage like, you know, 1 or 2 minutes alone setting up chairs and looking nervous and apprehensive, but also excited. I mean, that's the essence of letting a scene breathe. And then everyone walks in. Here's my first impression. I absolutely love that Bronn is a heartless bastard. I love it. Like, I do. Like, I know that lots of people were like, oh, but he secretly has a heart of gold. He would never kill the Lannister brothers. They mean too much to him. No, he absolutely would have killed the Lannister brothers if he felt like he had to get what he wanted. He really is a heartless bastard. Yeah. He's a charming heartless bastard, and he's really funny, and he's really smart, and he's a survivor. But he's a heartless bastard, and I love it. I love it. So the fact that he sort of swaggers in because he's gotten what he wanted and his little exchange with Davos where he's a hard ass, but he's like charming and funny the way Bronn always is. It was great.
Yeah. I love it too. And I think, and I'm pointing to it, like, I'm not trying to say that I think Bronn's going to become a heavy or like if this story continued to become a bad guy, I think it's just good that it shows you like, these people still exist.
Absolutely.
You know, like that, after everything that happened, Bronn's still Bronn.
There are still opportunists in this world.
Exactly. And that's going to, and they're going to disagree and they're going to have to figure out things about money and this and that. I thought that like you said, let it breathe. When at the end of something, when you have one character in a room alone, and you show the wide shots and you show them moving the inanimate things, what it brings to mind and what it makes happen is the ghosts of those who have been there before appear to the viewer. Yeah. So while he was pushing in the chairs, I was seeing Varys, I was seeing Littlefinger, I was seeing I was seeing Tywin, I was seeing Uncle Kevin even, right? Cersei, Jaime. people who have come and gone through that small council and through that seat of power, the decisions that were made there, just really wonderful. It was great to see. I love that Davos was there. Master of Ships. I still think that Davos for prime minister one day, I think when Bran opens elections, if Davos is still alive, he'll win.
Yeah.
I love him. I thought that it was funny. It was, I like the kind of loopy nature to it, how it just kept on, people were just talking, you know? Yeah. It kind of settled back.
Yeah. Well, Tyrion obviously has a different management style than than his father, yeah. Obviously. It's much more free form and looser, which is great because then you get the exchange of ideas, right? Because they were all like, because Bronn has a great line where he's like, you know, all the brothels burned down. I'm willing to fund the reconstruction of those. and then Sam chimes in, and then Davos chimes in, and then Brienne chimes in. It's funny. It's really funny. And it's great because what that said to me is that Bran has a deep bench. Yeah. He has maybe the best small council, the beginnings of a small council that maybe anyone's ever had.
And it was so nice too, Ken, that there wasn't in so many of these small council meetings, they do their little blah, blah, blah. Someone says a joke and then they go, and now the world is going to end. So we have to make a decision.
Right.
And there wasn't that.
Nope.
They could actually have fun and figure out new ways of, you know, plumbing and water and actually help people, you know, and do these types of things that Sansa could be helping them with. Yeah. Hopefully they listen to her.
That's the other great thing. It's like George has always done this, whereas like Tolkien didn't do so much of this. Martin has always done this, where he makes a point to talk about the nuts and bolts of real life, like about plumbing. And about, let's get these poor people food because they've been through a bunch of wars back to back and there are a lot of hungry people.
Yep. I love that stuff. I think it's great. Now, the interesting part is when Bran comes in, he does smile a couple of times, right? He seems much more human.
Yeah.
He seems relaxed. I loved it. He's got Pod pushing him around now. Pod is the new Hodor.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
I guess Pod could hold the door with his rod. I had to say it, Ken. I'm sorry. I had to say it. He could open the door with it.
That's right.
And not have to pay the toll. I could keep on going. But when Bran says, is there any word of Drogon? Right?
Yeah.
And then Tyrion, what does Tyrion say? They saw him in Essos or something?
Yeah, Sam says, last we saw him, he was heading east.
And then Bran says, perhaps I'll try to find him or something like that, right?
Yeah, he says, perhaps I can find him.
Yeah, and then he just kind of says, go about your business, and they turn around, and then they get the great shot, which is very purposeful, where Bran has his back turned and is being pushed away by Pod, and you get a shot of Bran kind of smiling a little, right?
Yeah.
Feeling very confident that they've got this under control. There's no scheming going on. There's the Game of Thrones, right? Is not really happening. There's no game anymore. I can just go back. But it leaves you with the idea that he can still warg. He can see what's happening in other places. It's just, I don't know, like, why was that line added there? I don't want to get too excited about theorizing a sequel or whatever, which I will when we get to the end here, which, because I felt like the end was kind of like three alternative sequels, like it was backdoor pilots. That was really kind of cool.
It was cool. And it for me personally, it was a reaffirmation within the same 10 or 15 minutes that Bran was the right choice.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ken, because it's like they didn't say it. And I know that there is a idea, and perhaps it's true, that this television show has really has kind of shied away from a lot of the magic, you know?
Yeah.
And it wants it to be more about the real characters. But to me, that was a little nod to it at the end. Like, don't forget, I'm magical. This is still a magical world. A lot of people talked about the end of this story is the end of magic. The dragons will go away. And I said, no, they have to learn to live with the magic. I guess I was right in that respect, because Bran is king. The dragon lives on. Jon's north of the wall. The magic lives on. This is a world where they had to learn to live with, you know, as one with the magic, attain balance.
And who better to normalize it than Bran?
Yeah, the most magical motherfucker there is.
Right, absolutely.
You know, I like it. So let's talk about Jon and the Starks. We have kind of a set of scenes that we jumped over where Jon's kind of like walked through.
Well, I kind of feel like you said it's all the same because it's all the resolution of the three remaining Starks, because we already know what Bran's resolution is by this point. We know that he's been elected king of the six kingdoms of Westeros. So now it's just left to our other core Stark characters, Jon, Arya, and Sansa. Dan and Dave did a brilliant job, not only in the short scene between Tyrion and Jon, where Tyrion tells Jon his fate, but then immediately when it goes into the sequence where it's cutting between the three characters, Jon, Sansa, and Arya, that couldn't have been more masterfully directed. That is the hardest I cried the first time I watched it on Sunday night. And I cried almost as hard on rewatch. And the thing that made me cry was that I thought about Ned and Catelyn. And I thought, and I feel like I'm going to start crying right now. But I was thinking that not a lot of characters in the show got to grow up with two parents.
Yeah.
And not only did the Stark children, with the exception of Rickon, have two parents who got to raise them, but they had extraordinary two parents. With the exception of the weirdness between Catelyn and Jon, Catelyn and Ned were supportive and loving. They embraced their children.
Oh, you know what? Anything I've ever said about Ned or Catelyn about their political or strategic war positions or whatever.
Yeah.
They were great parents. They love those kids. And at the heart of this story are two people who really loved each other and knew each other very well and very deeply and appreciated what they had as well. They weren't rich, stuck up people, right?
Right.
That Ned's honor may have been his downfall, but it was also his brilliance.
Well, yeah, because you had Catelyn, who was super clever, Ned, who was super honorable. But the thing that tied it all together was the love, the unabashed love that they showed their children and each other. And the children got to see their parents love each other. And so I feel like it was that love that ultimately saved those four Stark children. It saved Arya from making, that's why Arya made the choice with the Hound, when the Hound was like, go, because if you don't, you're going to die or you're going to become just like me. And it was her remembering her upbringing and the love that made her pick something else. And it was that love that made Jon survive all of the hardships that he's had to go through, and also got Sansa through the darkest chapters of her life. So I teared up just thinking about the legacy of Ned and Catelyn, and how I can see Ned and Jon, I can see Ned and Arya, I can see Catelyn and Sansa, and how their legacy lives on through the choices and the kinds of people that their children grew up to be.
Yeah. It's brilliant, man. It was really beautiful. And also in the many ways here, this whole episode is defined by Jon making this decision to kill Dany, a decision that Ned in the very beginning in season one would not make to do to Cersei.
Yeah.
And didn't listen to Varys, didn't listen to Littlefinger, didn't listen to himself, right? About what he should do. John kind of brings the circle to a close on that one. But this, what you're talking about, the love that they had, the pack survives, right?
Yes.
How Ned said how important it was to love each other.
Yeah.
And stress that, and John included in that, right? Yeah. And Theon included in that too.
Yes.
And the way that they always stayed together to the end. I have to mention Sansa's dress. Woo, that was beautiful. I love the way they put the sleeves on. And
then the weirwood leaves, the red weirwood leaves down at the skirt. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I thought she was getting married when the sequence first started and they showed her getting into a fancy dress. I'm like, is she getting married? Hmm. So I'm glad she wasn't getting married. Yeah. I'm glad she was getting named Queen of the North. I thought it was
great. And that, you know, we get to see them say Queen of the North, and Arya gets her little periscope out.
Yes.
And I love that she's going west of Westeros because everybody remembered that. And she is an amazing choice to be kind of, you know, like – who else would you feel more comfortable being out on her own in a new and distant place than the greatest assassin in all of the world? She could take care of herself. You know, she'll be okay.
Absolutely.
And John, too. We end as we began. The series began with the three men with the door opening. We see the door close. John. Now, I had a friend who texted me a couple days later. And said to me, do you think John will keep his oath to the Night's Watch? And I want to ask you, Ken, when you saw John ride off with Tormund and the Wildlings, wasn't it your impression that he was going to live with them?
It was my impression. Okay. It wasn't my impression until the gate started to close and he looked back.
Okay.
And the look on his face when he looked back.
Yep.
That said to me that John has evolved and that his honor has evolved.
Yep.
And that his sense of honor has evolved. And that John has figured out a way to make it work in his head that I'm going to leave the Night's Watch and go off with the Wildlings and never come back.
Yes, I agree. That's what I thought he did. That's what I thought he was doing. And Tormund had said to him, you have real northern blood in you.
Yeah.
And he does. And it goes back to the books and the mythology and the, you know, how the people of the north are different. And really, in a sense, with Sansa as Queen of the North, he didn't really have to do anything. You know what I mean? Like, if he had showed up at Winterfell 2 days later, what do you think Bran the King's going to do? The Unsullied already left to go to Noth, right?
Yes.
So it's not like they're going to come back to get Jon. So That's true. In essence, it was a silly it was the silliest of all of the proclamations that Jon should be sent to the Wall, because that was what he was going to choose anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know? I love how. This is also great writing. I love how open-ended each of their endings felt, but at the same time, it also felt final.
Yes, because it was the chapter closed and it's the opening of a new one.
Yeah.
But it's not the opening of a new war, a new battle, a new struggle. We don't know what that new struggle will be, but we know they will have them.
Yeah.
But we just know something new has begun. So you know what? Let's leave it at that, Ken. We're going to have lots more to talk about. I mean, I think you and I could do a whole episode just of like possible sequels here.
Yeah.
And so much more to talk about, but we've done a good amount of time here. I'll let you just, I don't want to cut you off. So is there any last thing that you want to say about this scene or the show?
Well, I kind of want to just focus, like my mind is focused on this episode. So I just want to say that it was everything that I thought it was going to be. It was a roller coaster. It was emotional. And I felt emotionally satisfied at the end of the episode. And I felt even more emotionally satisfied when I watched it again the next day. So it's been a great journey, both watching Game of Thrones and podcasting about it. And you're part of that, Axel. Like, you're part of the tapestry of my experience with the show.
Oh, thank you. You too.
And it's been great. It's been an experience that I'll never forget. So, I'm glad that I got to see it from beginning to end. And I look forward to my next artistic experience where something will touch me and blow my mind and make me think a million things. But for now, I'll just say that, that I'm happy that I got to go on this journey.
Ken, thank you, pal. It is, you know, I don't want to give a grand ending because we're going to keep on podcasting and we're going to keep on talking about the show. But while I was watching this episode, I did think a lot about that. And, you know, it's like I said, this is a great story and there's so many great stories out there. But the thing for me about what makes it really special is that it brought us all together, you know, and it's the same thing as Lost and so many of these things that we podcast, or whether it's Star Wars or things that bring people together, there can be division and people get upset about plots or stories or this or that. But in the end, we all care about it. And this particular story, because it's so grand, you know,
yeah,
it's so dramatic, but then it can also bring us down to the real human level of these characters is one that will live on for generations. And I really have to say, finally, about this particular episode, I'm glad that you and I had an opportunity to spend a couple of hours here just talking about a show that we love and loving this episode, because there's a lot of people who didn't like it. And some people may say that we're being too generous, but our emotions are real. And it was really fun. And I'm actually looking forward to rewatching the entire season and kind of seeing its place in the whole season itself. And I think I'll even like it more. And I want to thank you, Ken, for taking the time to podcast with me today. And I'm so glad that you're back. And we're doing it, baby.
We are. Thanks for having me on, Axel.
Oh, you're the best. And thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find us at podcastwinterfell.com, at dvrpodcast.com. We're going to be back talking. Actually, I think I'm going to do another show this week with Justin, and we're going to talk a little bit about also content creation and a little bit more about outside of the show too, but he's going to have some things to say about the finale. And then we'll be back to talk about the season and the series. And you're going to be watching the documentary on Sunday, right, Ken?
Absolutely. My eyes and ears will be glued.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So I can't wait to talk about that, because we get into production stuff and seeing how they shot things and all that. So we got a lot more to cover. Stick with us. Follow us on Twitter and all that. And oh, I am going to be giving away a pair of awesome Targaryen cufflinks. You can win those by sending us an email telling us your favorite moment of the entire series. I got a bunch of people writing in already, so hit us up at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. Your favorite moment of the series, and you can win a pair of great Targaryen cufflinks from cufflinks.com. So thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks again, Ken. Peace out.